Hello and welcome to Main Street on this Wednesday. I'm Craig Blumenschein. We hope you are enjoying your day. In the second half of today's show, Rick Gion stops by for another edition of Prairie Plates. Rick introduces Kayla Houchin, owner of Sonder Bakehouse in West Fargo, which is a creative and community-focused bakery. That'll be a tasty treat. Also, we'll have a report from Harvest Public Media on what it means to be certified naturally grown. And we begin Main Street today visiting about April and the fact that it's Sexual Assault Awareness Month here in North Dakota and across the country. Joining me to discuss is Seth O'Neill. He's the Executive Director of the North Dakota Domestic and Sexual Violence Coalition. Seth, welcome to Main Street.
Thanks, Craig.
Allison Wiedrich is the Sexual Assault Prevention Coordinator. Allison, welcome.
Thank you, Craig. I'm so happy to be here to discuss such an important topic today.
It's a very important topic. And Amy Rich, she's the Communications Coordinator. Amy, welcome to Main Street.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Good to have you back. Okay, as we begin this topic, I want to define the issue. Can you explain what image-based sexual violence is on the different form that it takes? And I should tell our listeners, there are many, many, many types of sexual assault that we could talk about. And we're going to kind of limit our discussion today just a little bit to maybe some things that you don't think about all the time relative to sexual assault and sexual violence. But I would like to have someone explain what image-based sexual violence is and the different forms it takes, such as non-consensual intimate image sharing, sextortion, and now deep fakes.
Thanks, Craig, for that question. So largely we can say that image-based sexual violence is any type of sexual abuse or harassment that takes place through a screen. And so, as you mentioned, one aspect of image-based sexual violence is non-consensual intimate image sharing. And this occurs when a bad actor shares an intimate image or video of someone without their consent. So this would include both images and videos originally obtained without consent. This might be through hacking phones, using hidden cameras, or recording sexual assaults, as well as images or videos that were originally consensually obtained within the context of an intimate relationship, for example, and later distributed without consent. The second aspect of this would be sextortion, as you mentioned. This term derives from the combination of the words sex and extortion, and put simply, offenders utilize images, intimate images and videos to threaten or take advantage of somebody. And so the offender will typically attempt to coerce someone to pay money, to send more nude or sexually explicit images, to perform sex acts, to stay in an abusive relationship, relinquish custody of children, or some other act that is against that person's wishes. And so the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, NCMEC for short, asserts that actually 79% of predators in these instances will seek money from victims of sextortion. And then last but not least, we have deepfakes. And this occurs when perpetrators make use of rapidly progressing technology like AI, artificial intelligence, to create and share intimate images or videos of someone without their consent. And even though these images are technically not real, they're artificial, they're still very harmful for the people that it impacts. And by using this technology, perpetrators can create sexually explicit material of people who have never even actually created or shared depictions of themselves in that way. So that's very scary. But those are all of the different forms.
I mean, you can really go to a website and take anyone's picture, and if I can use the term, and I think it's out there online, nudify anyone. Mm-hmm. And it looks real. And that's very scary. Here in the state, do we know how common image-based sexual violence is?
So we don't have any like local statewide statistics on this. I can speak a bit to national numbers. All forms of image-based sexual violence are on the rise, and this is largely due to increased access to technology, increased social media usage, especially among our youth, and then also bad actors who are willing to use those very things to take advantage of people across the world, really. And again, to cite the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, they do a lot of great work on this in collecting those national numbers. And so they have what's called a cyber tip line where people from across our nation can put in these reports if they've experienced sextortion, image-based abuse, things like that. So they actually are receiving an average of 812 reports of sextortion every week on their tip line. So it's a massive issue in our nation. And in 2023 alone, they received 26,718 reports of just financial sextortion. So again, this would be when the perpetrator is asking for some kind of financial gain to stop them from sending out those images of them.
But to be clear, this happens here.
Yes. Yes, we know that it is happening in our state. And I will go to Amy.
Yeah, Amy.
Yeah, and I just like to add, I mean, I think we can all agree that even one case is too many. You know, if that was our statistic, we know that this is happening in North Dakota, but even if there was just one case of this happening, one is too many.
There are emotional and psychological scars then on survivors. What do we know about that?
So yeah, the impact for victims of all forms of image-based sexual violence are very unique, but also have some similar impacts for them. One being job loss, which might not be talked about too much, or they have to disclose to their employer that this has happened to them. Sometimes bad actors, perpetrators, they will threaten to send it to their employer and threaten to do that and disperse it in that way. Damaged reputation may also be a fear for them. Bad actors we know may also threaten to send it to professors if they're in school, might threaten to send it to their parents, to their friends and family members, and then embarrassment, depression, anxiety, thoughts of self-harm or suicidal ideation we know is all common impacts for victims, unfortunately.
The other picture I want to paint is that, Allison, when you say bad actors, that can be the student down the block. Or that can be my neighbor that I just saw in the store. These bad actors, so to speak, can be folks we know.
For sure, yeah. They most certainly can be people that we know and that we trust, which also can add further harm for victims. A lot of sense of betrayal, maybe even shame that they trusted that person in the first place. So yeah, for sure, you're right on the dot there, Craig.
Are there legal protections that exist for victims of image-based sexual violence? And to pile onto that, are there any gaps in the law that need to be addressed?
Yeah, so to be clear, image-based sexual violence is against the law, and it's a crime if someone commits it. There's a few different provisions in North Dakota law related to this. One is distribution of intimate images without or against consent. And then there's another provision on sexual extortion. The North Dakota Legislative Assembly is considering a bill right now, House Bill 1351. And this would just clarify that deep fakes are also against the law. Currently, the deep fakes would be covered under the distribution of intimate images. But this just clarifies that more clearly, that deep fakes are against the law, and makes that known so the bad actors clearly know that what they're doing is wrong.
Seth, you receive funds from a lot of places, including the federal government. With the political headwinds that are out there relative to a lot of people who receive federal monies, do you have any concerns that are out there relative to how that money can flow to you and your organization?
That's a good question, Craig. So our organization as the coalition is approximately 95% federally funded. And so we're very reliant on federal funds. The 19 member organizations in our coalition, we recently surveyed them, and they're approximately 30% federally funded. And so it's something that we're all anxiously awaiting. We know that sexual and domestic violence is a nonpartisan issue. You know, we all want to support survivors. And so we're just doing what we can to educate legislators and our congressional delegation on the importance of these services. And we are seeking an increase in funding at the state level, because the state makes up only 16% of our member organization's budget. And we're encouraged that that effort will succeed, and the state will fund more of these efforts across the state.
Has any of your funding been interrupted by what's happening at the federal level?
Some of our funding was certainly paused when the initial executive orders went out, but we are continuing to receive our federal funding as scheduled. However, notice of grant opportunities that were available on the Department of Justice's website have been pulled, and so we are anxiously awaiting those grant opportunities to be back on the website so that we can apply for grants for the future.
Are you concerned that grants that used to be there won't be there anymore?
That's a good question. We are certainly concerned that that might happen, or the grant activities might change so much that it would be difficult to do our work. Again, we're just trying to do our best to educate lawmakers and our congressional delegation on the importance of these services. We provide these services in a nonpartisan manner, and it doesn't matter who someone is. And so we just know that this problem affects all of us. And so we want to do our best to continue providing these services.
And certainly victims are not concerned about partisan politics when it happens to them.
That's correct.
We're enjoying our conversations with Seth O'Neill. He's the executive director of NDDSBC, Allison Weidrich, the sexual assault and prevention coordinator, and Amy Ritz. She's the communications coordinator of NDDSBC. Technology just scares me from the aspect of, I feel so lucky that I didn't have to deal with so much of this when my children were growing up, and now parents across the state and across the country do have to deal with this. How has technology, including social media and AI, artificial intelligence, contributed to the rise of image-based sexual violence? And then also, what should parents know? What should they ask? What should they do to make sure that their kids are not impacted?
Yeah, technology's role is at the very center of this issue. These forms of abuse and harassment and exploitation could not exist without technology and social media. And further, deepfakes could not exist without artificial intelligence, AI. And as a society, I feel like we're really grappling and adapting to this major surge of AI technology just within the last couple of years. When this technology was first introduced, celebrities and public figures were the main targets for deepfakes. And this was largely due to AI technology needing multiple photos and videos of an individual in order to create a sexually explicit deepfake. And so typically that population then was public figures. But this is no longer the case. AI technology is so advanced that all you need is one photo of an individual to create a sexually explicit deepfake. Further, there are hundreds of free apps out there that bad actors can utilize to create these images. And there are numbers that say that the amount of sexually explicit deepfakes are doubling every 6 months. So, which is very, very scary. For parents to protect their children, I think something just really important is making sure you have any of those privacy settings on their social media accounts. Talk with them, make sure that they can trust you. We really promote the idea of having trusted adults so that if something like this does happen, they have someone they can go to have resources to talk through what they can do about it. Yeah, we just want them to be able to talk about it with people.
You touched on it just a second ago, Allison. Support for survivors. What resources are available to individuals who have been victimized by these image-based sexual violence attacks?
Yeah, so a great resource is the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, or NCMEC. And this could be both for the victims themselves and also their parents. And they have what's called a cyber tip line where you can basically just submit a report of what's happened to you and they can connect you with resources. Another thing is our victim service providers in our state. And so they have advocates that can help you with your options and what's out there to help you take down these images. Another resource is called Take It Down, and they can take down any intimate images out there of minors. So that's a really important resource as well. Another option for some people may be law enforcement, if they're comfortable with reporting to law enforcement. And seeking that route as well.
I think some people might think that, okay, this happened, we're going to kind of push it aside and move on. Is that the right advice?
No, I think it's important that victims know that help is out there, and really that it's not their fault. It's the fault and the onus should be on the perpetrator, on the bad actors who are committing these really egregious crimes against them. And so I would really want victims to know, and society in general, that it's not their fault, and that there are things out there that they can access and they can utilize, resources that they can go to nationally, but also locally in our state, and that they're not alone in this and it's not their fault.
Do we need to change the game the narrative, so to speak, to better support survivors?
Yes, and I think this goes for anything under our umbrella that we cover, domestic violence and sexual assault. There is so much stigma around all of these issues when it comes to image-based sexual violence, especially if they willingly took the images themselves. This is why it's so important to remember that consent to create an image does not equate to consent for its publication. And again, just to stress that image-based sexual abuse is caused by perpetrators and that it's not the fault of the victim if it's happened to you. And we really just want them to know that those resources are out there for them.
There's been debates since almost the beginning of time relative to social media and the internet of who should be held accountable. Mm-hmm. Should those platforms be held accountable? What role do social media companies have in this? Tech platforms play in this, in the prevention of spreading non-consensual intimate images? And are they doing enough?
Yeah, so the short answer is no, that they definitely could be doing more. I do want to quote Dawn Hawkins, the CEO of the National Center on Sexual Exploitation. She has a great quote. She says that it's outrageous that tech companies can instantly remove copyrighted material. So if you upload a clip from Disney or a Taylor Swift song, it's gone in a heartbeat. And you might even risk an immediate ban from a platform like YouTube or Instagram. But yet, if you upload something like a sexual assault, if you hide a camera in a locker room, or you want to destroy someone's life by sharing private images of them, you can do so without scrutiny. And the platforms won't blink, and the perpetrators can sleep easily at night, knowing that they face no real consequences. We also see some current legislative gaps that are hopefully being addressed that allow both the platforms and the initial uploaders of this abuse to completely evade accountability. Further, I just want to speak to Meta. So they are kind of the overhead of Instagram and Facebook. They recently implemented what's called end-to-end encryption. This essentially just makes it difficult for tech companies to detect explicit materials, and it blocks our law enforcement agencies from obtaining access to the content. In contrast, sites that are not encrypted, that are non-encrypted, they can search their systems for this harmful material using what they call hash values or photo DNA. And if listeners are seeking further information on the role of social media on tech companies, the National Center on Sexual Exploitation has a lot of great information on their role and ways to hold them accountable. But again, the short answer is no, that they can definitely be doing more.
Amy, what's your role as communications coordinator to get this message where it needs to be heard, oftentimes with maybe younger students at the middle school? How do you reach those folks that, hey, you do not need to share intimate pictures of yourself with anyone?
Yes. So part of our role as the North Dakota Domestic and Sexual Violence Coalition is we provide training for direct service providers in the state. So that would be the victim service providers who are directly working with sexual assault victims, but also law enforcement and social service professionals, legal professionals. So we are training and educating those people that are directly working with victim survivors so that they have the knowledge to help victims and address these issues. But we are also involved in news media. You know, we're involved in articles and interviews like this to get the word out about this. We're active on social media. We have tons of information on our website on domestic and sexual violence. And then also we coordinate statewide awareness campaigns. So April is actually Sexual Assault Awareness Month, as you mentioned. And so part of our job with these awareness campaigns is to talk about these issues and get the word out. We coordinate awareness materials that we send out to victim service providers, and those awareness materials spread messages about consent and why it's so important and how we can support survivors and ultimately prevent any sexual violence before it occurs.
Seth, do we know whether these numbers are increasing relative to image-based sexual violence? Do you track those numbers? Do we know if it's becoming more of an issue here in the area?
Yeah, that's a good question, Craig. So we do track the amount of sexual assault or sexual violence people that have been sexually assaulted. We track those amounts that our programs, our member organizations have provided, and those numbers continue to climb every year. We haven't released our 2024 numbers yet, but our 2023 numbers were right around 1,200. And so those are just the individuals that our member organizations serve. The actual amount is certainly way higher, and especially with image-based sexual violence, oftentimes those don't get reported. And so We know just anecdotally that those numbers are increasing, especially as we're talking about with the easy access to technology that is making this easier for individuals to engage in.
In your analysis, do we know why this is becoming more of a problem? And I ask that from the context of we're trying to get information out. And I think many folks have been trying to get information out about this issue for quite a while, yet it becomes more and more of a problem. We analyzed why that is.
Yes. So it does depend on the different types of image-based sexual violence. For instance, for sextortion, we have that financial sextortion piece, which would be the main purpose for that is to extort people for finances, for financial gain. Further, the FBI has tracked a lot of this to other countries, such as Nigeria or the Ivory Coast, which makes it really hard to crack down on it. And then for other instances like non-consensual intimate image sharing, the motivation there might be just to obtain power and control over the victim, to have that sense of domination over them and controlling their actions and making them fearful of what may happen.
I would just like to add, if anyone out there has experienced any form of sexual or domestic violence, you can find help on our website. If you go to nddsvc.org, there is a tab that says Find Help, and you will be directed to a map and directory of domestic violence and sexual assault advocacy organizations. Every single one of those centers can help you navigate your options and stay safe, whether that includes finding legal help, speaking to law enforcement, just getting mental health support. They can help you navigate what your options are and help you figure out what's best for you.
There could be a student who is listening to this saying, that's me. There's no way I can tell my parents, but maybe there is help for me. That's a tough question. That's a tough dilemma there. What should they do?
Well, our member organizations, those advocacy centers across the state, they do provide confidential support. So if you are looking to even just make a phone call, they aren't going to notify your parents against your consent. The help that they provide is free to you. So even if you don't want to tell them your name or where you go to school, you can just say, hey, you know, I have a friend that this happened to, and I want to know what they should do, or how could they get help? Where could they report this? And those advocacy organizations can help them, even if they are afraid of, you know, saying that it's them that it's happening to. So even if there's a fear or a stigma around that happening to you, you can still receive help. But the important thing is that you do reach out, because you're not alone. This happens to people across North Dakota, people across the nation. And we just want to make sure that everyone's staying safe and getting the help that they need.
Our guests today have been Seth O'Neill, the Executive Director of the North Dakota Domestic and Sexual Violence Coalition, Allison Wiedrich, the Sexual Assault and Prevention Coordinator, and Amy Britz, the Communications Coordinator for NDDSVC. And I think if we take anything away from this panel, it's if you experience this, reach out, get help.
For certain, yep.
Thank you all for joining us. Still to come on Main Street, it's Wednesday. That means it's Prairie Plates with Rick Guillon. Rick introduces Kayla Houchin, owner of Sonder Bakehouse in West Fargo. It's a creative and community-focused bakery. Stay with us.
I like bagels.
All I eat is pizza.
Eat some barbecue.
Applesauce and some nice red beets.
Well, there's the walk-up music, and this is another segment of Prairie Plates on Prairie Public, a weekly segment highlighting a lot of the food innovators around the region. And in the studio today is what I consider a food artist, and we're going to talk about Easter sweet treats, because she owns this bakery in West Fargo called Sonder Bakehouse, and the products are fantastic. And it's not a well-known place. It's kind of a well-kept secret, and we're trying to, I guess, it won't be a well-kept secret anymore after this, but it's just a really, really fun place to be, and the products are amazing. So Kayla Houchin is the owner and head baker. Thanks for joining us today. How are you?
I am good. I'm happy to be here. Thanks for asking. I don't even know if I would say I'm the head baker anymore. There are lots of other people that bake other things too. I bake majority of the macarons and the cheesecakes and kind of have my hand in everything. But there's someone else that bakes all the cakes and makes majority of the frostings.
Well, you brought some macarons today. Can you explain to folks what a macaron is? I'm very familiar. I love these macarons, the Fruity Pebble macarons and the birthday cake macarons. And she's been making, for those that are on TikTok, Dubai chocolate macarons. But Kayla, can you explain what a macaron is?
So kind of reminds me of like a sandwich cookie. There's two separate parts and then there's some sort of filling. And what I really like about them is there's so many different things that you could put in them. And lots of our flavors, you know, we've created ourselves because I just feel like you can put so many different things in it, whether it's a ganache or some sort of pastry cream or a curd or just some sort of frosting you really like. Let's see. I did two of the three flavors that you mentioned. I've got Fruity Pebbles.
Yes.
And that one has become really popular, which kind of surprised me. So even, for instance, I feel like there's so many other cereals and stuff that you could take and just... You know, that's the fun, what I have so much fun with sometimes is experimenting and just playing around. We recently, for St. Patrick's Day, we did a Lucky Charm one. And I just ran, so I separated the marshmallows from the cereal, and I ran that cereal through a food processor till it was fine crumbs. And then I just made some vanilla buttercream and then added that to it. And then we put the, on the outside of the shell, we just did a little white chocolate ganache drizzle, and then I set a... like one Lucky Charm on it, but those went over well. I just think it's just fun to experiment and play, and I don't think people realize how many different flavors you can make in combinations.
Well, I've tried quite a few of them, but it looks like today I'm going to try a few more, so that's I'm looking forward to that. You also make what I would consider super pro cakes. I mean, these cakes look fantastic. They're artistic. I think they're some of the best cakes in the state of North Dakota. How did you get into baking and how did you get to that level?
I grew up baking with my babysitter Carla in the kitchen. That's where it all started. That is kind of all I knew was her kitchen. You know, there's photos, I must be 4 or 5, and I'm sitting on the counter helping her mix or watching her. So she always let me make the biggest messes in her kitchen. Like she never, it was amazing. I don't ever remember her saying like, you can't be in the kitchen today. Like it's like I had free reign with her. And so then I guess that's kind of where it all started. And it really hasn't stopped. She spends about 30 hours with me in the kitchen a week. She is, she'll turn 79 in a couple of weeks, and
wow.
She makes all of our cakes and most of our frostings and lots of the cookies. She is, it's hard to describe Carla. She's kind of the heart of the bakehouse to me.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's an interesting story. And I started making cookies with my dad when I was like 3 or 4 years old. So kind of a similar story there. But so you have a group of folks that really help you at Sonder. It's a group effort.
It is now. It's definitely become that. I wish I was in the kitchen more some days, but there's just lots of other things to, as you would know, or just trying to run a small business. So I'm still in the kitchen a lot, but not as much as I wish I was, quite frankly. And then we've got, she just came up on 2 years with us, her 2-year anniversary. Gracie, she is really, really good at what she does. We've got all sorts of ages. She'll turn 20 soon. So it's like we've got 15-year-olds to 79-year-olds at the bakery. So we're kind of all over our ages. And I kind of think that's really cool, though. I like it. One of the things I try to do, or, you know, if I can or if I seat someone, and it's like you want to hire people that are better than you at things. And she has gotten so much better at decorating cakes than I have. I actually haven't decorated a cake in months. Yeah. And I... once in a while I miss it, but I'm also like, there's lots of other things I'm doing. And it's like, oh my gosh, just watching her, she makes it look effortless and she's very good at it. So I love just bringing people on board that have, you know, other talents and probably enjoy it as much as I do.
So with that background, and Sonder Bakehouse is located at 3223 Oak Ridge Loop East in West Fargo. They're kind of in these newer business condos. You have to look for it. It's really a neat location. But with all of that background, what is Sonder Bakehouse and what does that name mean to you?
So it wasn't always Sonder. It always has been in that building, but when I was, this was a while ago, this was like July 2011, I made a Facebook page to start taking orders, and it was just kind of a whim. Me and, like, it was two of my roommates and myself, and we just kind of came up with the name on a whim, and it didn't really mean much to me. It was Indulgence Baking Company, but it was fine, and it served its purpose. And then when I was traveling in November of 2019, I was in Seattle and I came across the word Sonder, and it was essentially a made-up word. It is now like in the dictionary or going to be. I can't remember it, John. I'm trying to think of the guy that kind of coined the term. But his definition of it was just kind of the realization that every stranger, every passerby, every person you meet, you know, they've got their own struggles and hopes and dreams and ambitions, and just that every story is worth sharing and celebrating. And that just really resonated with me. And I really enjoy meeting new people. And that's, I think, a big part of the, you know, why I like traveling so much, too. I couldn't get that word out of my head. I thought about it nearly every day. And then COVID hit, so I had some downtime. I was teaching part-time at the time, and that all went online. And I remember I got home from a vacation Saturday night, and they called school off Sunday night. And that evening, so I was home for like a day, I booked a one-way to Alaska to spend some time with my family. So I ended up being there for 6 weeks. But then during that time frame, I reached out to a graphic artist and we rebranded, and Sonder Bakehouse was what I came up with.
That's a really interesting story. And I really do like the logo. It's really neat. Yeah.
He did such a wonderful job. Yeah. Adam Weedman. I wouldn't change anything about it. It was interesting, though, too, because I didn't know why I was doing this. I didn't have a store. I just, you know, I took orders through, like, email and Facebook and was just, that's all I'd ever done. And then I was like, gosh, I'm kind of, you know, putting some money into this. Like, where's this going? I had no idea. And then with COVID and just changes and feeling a little lost for a while there, I've been thinking, maybe I'm going to move to Alaska. Am I going to teach next fall? Like, what am I going to do? But then August 1st, I came out with the rebrand, launched it on Facebook and just social media, so just Instagram too. And then August 22nd, so like 22 days later, I signed a contract to build the location that I'm at now. It all happened very quickly. I remember looking at that lot, that empty lot, on a Monday afternoon, and signing a contract on Wednesday morning. And then, you know, that really changed my life, just signing that and the trajectory of that. And just the week before that, I told the school that I wasn't coming back. And I still didn't know what I was doing, but I just felt like I was being pulled in another direction. And I just needed to see what that was.
It's interesting when life happens that way, and I think you made a good decision. So what did you teach, Kayla? I'm curious.
No, not really. Okay, so a little bit. So I have a degree in PE and health. So physical education from NDSU. I taught elementary PE for a couple years.
Wow.
But then the 1 year before that, I remember applying for the PE job. They called me back. They said, that position's filled. Would you like to be our family and consumer science teacher and teach grades 7 through 12? And I did it for a year, which that was, I really, really treasure that. It was such a wonderful experience. And, you know, there were a couple cooking classes and there was a foods class, and they were also really small classes. I taught in a really small school in North Dakota. I taught in my hometown.
That's really neat.
And I took that job for one reason. I had a really special relationship with my facts teacher, and I had her for 7 years. And she passed away like a month after I graduated high school. So I don't know. It was crazy, but her file cabinet, the previous teachers, or the ones after her, a lot of those, they didn't touch any of her things. So I'm going through it and like I see, I'm like, we did that. Like there's like a group photo and I was in it and just seeing all her projects and I used a lot of them. So yeah. But then that was just really fun too, because like this one small class, I made a couple cakes with them and we did some extra desserts and stuff because I just.
You have a passion for it.
Yeah. You could say that.
Are you offering any cooking classes now? I think I have seen some stuff on social media where you may offer things or may through like if folks make a donation to a nonprofit or something like that, then you will do some cooking classes or something like that.
We do a few things. I would really like to expand on that. Done macaron classes, yes. Which that's what we do most. That's kind of what usually fills in kind of what I feel like I've become a little bit known for. There's usually 10 to 12 of those a year. And there's just 8 people. And then every time I have an experience in the kitchen, money goes to this organization called Charity Water. So example, for the macaron class, $25 goes. And then let's say it fills, that's $200, which would bring 5 people clean water and truly just change everything in their life.
Yeah, discuss that nonprofit. I do see that on your Facebook page quite a bit.
So, Saunders, just like any business, I think your mission is, you know, way beyond you, and it's not even about you. So I want to reach not just this community. I want to impact the world globally because 1 in 10 people don't have access to life's most basic need, and that's clean, safe drinking water. Yeah, hundreds, thousands. I mean, if I had it my way, I'd transform millions of lives. So there's all those experiences in the kitchen or anytime. You can also, people can rent out the space. We've had a couple grad parties in there, birthday parties. Also where like I've rented or they've rented it and I've baked things with them and done things with them. Or they can rent it out and not do anything like with me in the kitchen. That kind of just depends on their budget and what they want to do. And then, so every time the space is being used, every time communities in their Charity Water is getting something. And that just really is, you know, just a big motivator for me and what the whole mission of Sonder is. And then I host a gala now.
Yeah.
So that's coming up May 14th.
Yes.
So, and
what's the location?
It's at the Pines, Black. It's Wednesday evening this year. This will be the third one. So there's, you know, just a Charity Water rep that, you know, tells us a whole lot more about the issue. And there'll be a live auction this year with some cheesecakes.
Boy, those cheesecakes look really good. I was eyeing this turtle cheesecake. And I was about to zip over, and I live down in downtown Fargo, and that's a drive.
Oh,
but boy, that turtle cheesecake looked delicious.
That is the first thing that people started paying me to make.
Really? I can see why.
Which is another story we probably don't have time for. But yeah, when I was 16, people started asking me if they could pay me to make a cheesecake. So
my brother was a pastry chef too, and he was at Little Fields, which is a restaurant that was around about 20 years ago in West Fargo too. And he was a pastry chef and he really made some great cheesecakes. So I got an eye for cheesecakes.
Does he have a degree then?
No, he learned all of that stuff. He actually has 2 master's degrees, 1 in therapy and then 1 in art history. And he's in Chicago right now. I wish he was up here because we used to cook together and do all sorts of fun parties and stuff like that. So I really miss him. But yeah, aww. I mean, he used to cook some mean cheesecake. So it brought back some memories. Kayla, how can listeners help or get involved with your nonprofit? How can they find out more about it?
Saunderbakehouse.com. If they go to the website, they can read about the upcoming event. They can purchase tickets. They can purchase tables. If they have any questions, I have, you know, I put my phone number on there, my email. Because, yeah, this is really the time where I am trying to sell lots of tables and tickets. And, yeah, because I'd like a couple hundred people to be there again. And then just, you know, any class. But then there's been times, too, where I've sat down with someone because they wanted to learn more about Charity Water. I'm always more than happy to do that. And I will say that I do not work for Charity Water. I get asked that a lot. It's so funny. But I've just gotten to know a lot about it just through the people that work there and have they treat you like family, even though I'm, you know, just a supporter, a donor. They're really unique in the way that they operate. They reinvented charity, if you ask me.
Well, it really sounds like a worthwhile cause. And you're right about water. I mean, it's a human need. People need clean water to live, basically. And so good for you for putting that together and working on that initiative. That's really neat.
Thank you.
Again, where can folks find Sonder Bakehouse on social media? We mentioned sonderbakehouse.com, right?
Yes,
but
yep.
Throw those social media channels out.
And then really just two more that we're active on, Instagram and Facebook.
And your products are very Instagram worthy, I will say.
You're too kind.
They're made for Instagram. Well, there's a reason we had you on today. I really think what you're doing is innovative, artistic, and it's just really something that we don't see a lot of in our area. So it's just a very unique shop, not only with the products, but the location and just the space and all of those things. Kayla, thanks for coming in today for another edition of Prairie Plates. We'll have you in again sometime.
I would come back anytime. This was a pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
That sounds good.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Josh Beauchet, broker and realtor with Real Broker LLC. With a team of agents serving homebuyers, sellers, and investors throughout North Dakota, the Detroit Lakes area, and Northwest Minnesota. Josh can be reached at 701-367-3513.
Welcome back to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Certified Naturally Grown, CNG, is emerging as a more affordable and accessible alternative to the USDA organic label, offering similar ecological standards through a peer review process that appeals to small farmers, as we learn in this story from the Mississippi River Basin Ag and Water Desk that's distributed through Harvest Public Media.
As they hear Jennifer Dunsing approaching, the heads of three pigs pop out of their shed. Those footsteps mean it's feeding time. They trot through an open space to meet Dunsing, the owner of Illinois Country Harvest.
Yeah, they think they're going to get fed, so come talk to us.
These pigs eat USDA organic feed and vegetables that Dunsing grows on the farm. And in 2 months' time, when they're butchered and processed, that pork will be considered organic too. Kind of. Instead of going through the USDA's organic certification process, Dunsing uses an alternative label called Certified Naturally Grown, or CNG. It's been around since 2002, and it has mostly the same regulations as the USDA.
A lot of farmers are committed to ecological practices and probably would qualify for organic certification, but they hesitate because of the expense and also the paperwork.
That's Alice Varin, the executive director of CNG. She says CNG is a more accessible option for small farmers who sell directly to consumers. Under both programs, farmers go through an annual review of their practices. Organic farmers pay an agency, while CNG farmers turn to other farmers. In other words, it's a peer review process.
It helps keep the program affordable for the farmers because they're not paying someone to come out and do the annual inspection.
Liz Graysnack runs Happy Hollow Farm out of Jamestown, Missouri. Her whole farm is certified USDA organic.
I pay them, you know, whatever their set fees are, and then I have to pay the travel expenses for the person that's coming to inspect the farm. So it's usually a couple, $2,000-$3,000 a year.
CNG's annual fee is just $250. But Graysnack says the higher fees are worth it because the USDA organic label carries more cachet. And that's especially important because she sells at farmers markets and grocery stores.
The public knows what the USDA label is. They recognize that. And it means something.
At the Columbia, Missouri Farmers Market, David Lovelady just bought some veggies from Graysnack. It's important to him that his food is grown without synthetic pesticides. But the endless number of labels, organic, grass-fed, farm-raised, cage-free, makes it hard to make informed decisions.
It's a leap of faith.
Other patrons agreed, and most of them have never heard of CNG.
Well, I would need more information to have an understanding of what does certified naturally grown mean. What does that mean?
Sharon Gray is with the University of Connecticut's Department of Extension. She educates people about nutrition and what food labels do and don't mean. She says there are a ton of food labels out there that sound good, like natural.
People do like purchasing natural foods. I think right now it's just the definition isn't clear enough that people buy it and it's not necessarily regulated.
Certified naturally grown needs trust and recognition to not get lumped in with meaningless marketing labels. So they applied for money from the USDA and got $400,000 to help local farms in central Arkansas and western Virginia. There, they'll train farmers on marketing and outreach. But a lot of farmers aren't too worried about marketing or labels. Jennifer Dunzing, with the pigs, sells directly to her customers and is able to have conversations with them about how exactly she raises her crops and her critters. She still goes through the CNG process because it gives her assurance and appears oversight that she's sticking to the guidelines.
I also feel like some people who say that they grow naturally and don't go through the certification process may not have the correct understanding of what growing naturally is.
Ultimately, for her, any label is much less important than knowing she's growing food in a way that sits right with her and her customers. I'm Harshon Ratnapal.
That story was distributed by Harvest Public Media, which is a collaboration of public media newsrooms throughout the Midwest and Great Plains. It reports on food systems, environment, and rural life.
Support for PrePublic is provided by Books on Broadway and Dakota Soda and Coffee Company of Williston, featuring coffees and a wide variety of books for children and adults. Books on Broadway, the independent bookstore for independent minds.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 2nd. North Dakota Agricultural College opened on January 3rd, 1892 with 123 students. Farmers were initially skeptical that college boys could help them improve their farms. However, they were pleasantly surprised as professors took students out into the field to consult with farmers through the Extension Service, offering in-person courses and consultations. Even before the college's Extension Service, farmers were receiving help from another source. On this date, in 1819, American Farmer magazine published its first issue. This was followed by other publications, including Power Farming, Farm Mechanization Magazine, and Farmer and Stock Breeder. These magazines were once essential resources for farmers, offering advice on mechanizing farms, new planting techniques, breeding tips, and products that would revolutionize farming. They kept rural farmers connected with the latest agricultural developments happening around the world. The idea of farming magazines also caught the attention of manufacturers. In 1895, John Deere began publishing The Furrow, which is now considered legendary in publishing circles. It started as an advertisement for John Deere products, focusing on quality over price with the slogan, "Not the cheapest, but the best." By the early 1900s, The Furrow began to include informational articles, and by 1912, it had a circulation of 4 million subscribers. Early farmers in North Dakota faced many challenges. Breaking ground and planting crops was hard work, with threats posed by grasshoppers, hail, frost, too much rain, or not enough. Over time, the soil quality declined. Farms were often isolated, and farm families had to rely on themselves. Farming magazines helped keep farmers connected with the outside world and informed about the latest farming innovations. Magazines also featured articles for farm wives, including recipes, new home appliance advancements, and tips for making their work easier. Farming magazines remain popular today, with many available online. Agriculture has undergone massive changes since American Farmer was first published, but vintage farming magazines are still available for collectors. They offer a fascinating glimpse into the world of farming and the evolving landscape of agriculture. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Ann Olquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
What President Trump's Liberation Day means for the global economy on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
And that's a wrap for today's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, two young innovators are leading a movement that proves food isn't just fuel, it's medicine. We'll have an episode of Conversations on Healthcare, and we hope you can join us right back here again on Main Street.